You're listening to Teatro Mundi Live. I'm Andrea Cetrullo, Program Curator at Teatro Mundi, and this is the second episode of Hybrids, a podcast series focusing on the notion of hybridity as mixture, contamination, and symbiosis. How do apparently distinct entities, be they human or not, interact, feed from each other, and combine their individualities in order to create something entirely new? We invited four guests to answer this question through the lens of choreography, architecture, medical history, mathematics, ecology, and gastronomy. My guest for this first episode of the Hybrids podcast series is architect, illustrator, and co-editor of the Feral Atlas, Fei-Fei Zhou. Feral Atlas is a digital project that documents and expands the understanding of what occurs when non-human entities become tangled up with human-made infrastructures. We will discuss Fei-Fei's involvement with Feral Atlas, how she conceives and develops her illustrations for the site, and what her next project is about. How can architects and designers think about their role in creating and managing the world of the feral? Hello, Fei-Fei. Welcome to the first episode of Hybrids. It is great to have you here to talk about the project you're involved with called Feral Atlas. And I want to start by asking you to introduce yourself and tell us about your work with Feral Atlas.
Hi, everyone. My name is Fei-Fei Zhou. You're welcome to call me Fei. I am, I would say, an architect and artist, mainly interested in spatial representations and research in the kind of undesigned effects of infrastructures in our built and natural environments. Right now, I'm a visiting critic at Cornell University. I used to teach at Central St. Martin's, University of the Arts, London, last year for the architecture department. I enjoyed teaching very much. So with Feral Atlas, the kind of whole long journey started actually when I was still a student. I was working on my graduate project at the Royal College of Art, very interested in mushrooms, particularly the Matsutake mushrooms. Anyone who's familiar with Anna Singh's book, Mushroom and the End of the World, will know why my fascination, come from. So I get to know Anna's book relatively later than I learned about Matsutake mushroom, because it was quite a famous edible mushroom. It's extremely valuable in China. So I really wanted to do a project that explore this kind of relationship between non-human species and our built environment, and how this kind of value system actually can become a positive stance that we can utilize to help protect the environment. So that was where I was coming from. And I started reading Anna's book, got really hooked by, her exploration on this capitalist ruin and how this kind of disturbed landscape actually provided a great condition for this really valuable mushroom to emerge and somehow, become this whole ecosystem, not just for the nature itself, but also for the humans, the people picking the mushrooms, selling to the markets, and all this kind of commodity chain going around and within as well. So I reached out to Anna. She replied. We managed to meet in Santa Cruz, where she was teaching. She's a professor at UCSC, during which I was showing her my drawings. She was telling me about this new project called Feral Atlas. This is where the conversation began. And then later she invited me to contribute to make these large-scale drawings, which now we call the Anthropocene Detonator Landscapes. Yeah, and that's where it all began, really.
And could you tell us who Anna Singh is, actually? Because you've been referring to her a few times, but perhaps our audience is not familiar with her work.
Sure. Anna Singh is a professor in anthropology She teaches at University of California, Santa Cruz. She also teaches at Aarhus University for its anthropological department. So she led AURA, which is AURA Anthropocene, Aarhus University Research in the Anthropocene. Took me a while to remember the name. So Ferroatlas is kind of this baby that the birthplace of Ferroatlas is AURA. It came from multiple conversations with different scholars, and the idea of compiling all these field observations that kind of looking at very similar topic, which is this undesigned effects to the ecological world that perhaps has been neglected by many other disciplines. So she has published many books. I think the most famous one is A Mushroom at the End of the World. I've also read some other books of fiction, Friction and The Arts of Living on a Damaged Planet. So she's really amazing in terms of really articulating and analyzing these kind of intertwined relationships between non-human species and human-built environments. So I've took so much inspiration from her work, and I'm very privileged to be one of her collaborators right now.
Feifei, you mentioned the Anthropocene, which is a term that we hear more and more about. Yet not everyone might have a clear idea of what it means or entails. Could you explain what this term means, the Anthropocene?
So Anthropocene to me is this current ecological epoch really we are in, that the activities, the effects of human activities has become this dominant effect on the natural environment, and some which become irreversible. So Ferroatlas essentially arguing, you know, we are living in this planet right now that we're constantly being kind of encountering with flooding, drought, epidemics, and invasive species, and all these kind of increasingly prevalent phenomena, which we call the natural disasters, essentially is the Anthropocene. But Ferroatlas is very interested in this kind of non-human species responses to human-built infrastructures. For instance, Chernobyl, so nuclear radiation, has affected certain insects to develop that, you know, one leg is longer than the other, or certain deformation on the bodies. And this is kind of the residue of radiation that has on non-human species. Or chimneys exhaust, you know, carbon dioxide actually floating in the air, and it could affect on so many other levels, in the air, in the earth, in the water. So these are kind of the infrastructure effects, but somehow get tangled up with other non-human species. And these sort of interactions is what we as Ferroatlas are interested in, and what we call the Anthropocene. So in the publication itself, we've accumulated 79 field reports, and each kind of expand from a what we call the feral entity, these kind of non-human species, living or non-living, and tied up with a series of infrastructure programs, and how this kind of interactions, how this intertwined relationship has essentially made up the Anthropocene.
You just introduced the term infrastructure. So this leads us to the question of architecture. And as you said, you're trained in architecture. And how do you link the act of intentionally designing something or building as an architect to the feral or the non-human?
To me, what's very interesting is these kind of what we call the infrastructure effects are not necessarily the easiest to notice, which is why as a research publication, we're really interested in exploring what different methodologies are noticing it. From the research I've done, the conclusion really is some of the long-term environmental effects is firstly unevenly spreaded on different human communities and non-human species. They are slow, they're long-term, and they're very different, and they will remain hidden. So right now, you know, we have these kind of regulations that different architectural institutions has imposed on the building and the construction projects, which is great at the starting point, but to me, it still remains short-sighted in a sense that we are not paying enough attention to the histories of the ecology as well as the social histories that we need to understand before we start designing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not to say we need to, you know, predict the future to understand exactly how this particular architectural project will have this sort of spatial effects, but it's for us to kind of understand these previously neglected legacies of infrastructure or construction or these kind of built projects that perhaps has brought to the ecological world and to other human communities, you know, water pollutions, displacement, exploitation of materials. And this kind of process of paying attention will inevitably making the design process or the research process longer, taking more time, taking more effort. But arguably to me, this is also the price we're paying right now for making everything so easy, so accessible, because this kind of consequences is accumulating. You know, garbage right now is piling up in the ocean because we've been so used to dumping all our garbage. And right now, water is being intoxicated by all these chemicals because pharmaceutical companies is being so easy to just dumping all the sewage in the water channels or got mixed up. So right now, it really become critical for us to take the time before every project starts to really investigate into these complications and relationships that our project might, you know, have an impact on.
And so are you working with certain architectural practices or, let's say, research centers or different kinds of practitioners across disciplines to build?
So right now I'm working on, this is one of my biggest projects, which is another collaboration at University of California, Santa Cruz. So again, led by Professor Anna Singh and a group of other very brilliant social and natural scientists in and out of the United States. So we kind of have a global network between the US and Southeast Asia to look at particularly the land-water interaction, this kind of really interesting interface that happening at coastal areas. And this is important to point out that Southeast Asia's coastline has been one of the most diverse areas, not just the biodiversity, but also cultural diversity. Whereas that is going through a drastic change in impact by infrastructure project, such as seawalls, land reclamation, and dams, all these kind of large scale infrastructures. And it has this rationale behind, populations growing, there's an increasing demand on land, on resource. But at the same time, these projects happen so fast that we all know, you know, right now Pakistan's going through a huge impact in terms of flooding. Parts of Indonesia has been flooded all the time, considering it's actually dry season. So Anna has just come back from her field work in Indonesia and showing me all these photos, which is really bizarre that it's just so unexpected on the dry season that it's been flooded almost every single day. So and Jakarta is as a capital is sinking so heavily that Indonesia's parliament have to relocate the capital. So these are kind of the world phenomena that we're living with right now, and it's happening so fast, and these kind of urgent matters that really require solutions. So I'm working with these scholars and putting funding together to actually go to Southeast Asia next year to be able to really observe what was there, such as indigenous architecture, and how that has worked really well in ways of incorporating these local ecosystems into domestic livelihood practices, but now being replaced by other forms of living, such as this kind of more urbanized and industrialized lifestyle, and how we can use these kind of different forms of observations, different forms of knowledge making to perhaps coming up with alternative solution of architecture.
Yeah, I think you've already answered this question, partially at least, but on the theme of the role of the architect or designer, could you give us a specific example of how design can facilitate relationships to allow them to flourish more organically rather than pre-establishing or defining them as such?
Mm-hmm. So to me, the term design, a term architecture, and who is the architect has always been a very interesting series of questions. When I was writing my proposal for this project that I call the Between Land and Water Architecture of Porosity, I love to refer the indigenous communities as the architect, because the wisdom of indigenous architecture has been neglected and overlooked for a long time. You know, they've been seen as obsolete, they're seen as no value to be preserved, which is why they've been replaced by these concrete structures. For my research before, when I was working on the Mastake project, I've spent some time in a Tibetan village in Southwest China to really observe the way they start building. And it's very interesting because Tibetan Buddhism has their own very intimate relationship with their forest. And they worship forest not to merely just preserve it. They actually do log. And that kind of logging process, strategically understanding which tree to cut and how do we preserve it, how do we make it come alive again next year, this kind of paying attention to the cycle of life is what Tibetan Buddhism happening in this village was really paying attention to. And I was really fascinated by this process of forming a relationship with the material. And I've also observed, so I did a talk invited by IAC Institute in Barcelona, and they took us to their other research center. I think it's called Valdora Labs, which is located slightly outskirts of Barcelona in this kind of woody, foresty area. And what's very interesting is the students and the professors there have their kind of piece of forest that they are kind of sourcing the material from, and they marked very carefully each tree. So when they log, they understand which tree they're cutting and how we can kind of give back to the forest by either planting or letting it grow back. So this kind of very interesting, intimate relationship between the architect slash the designer and the client in this case, who are using the material and living in what the material is constructing for, and the forest, in this case, is a material. And that kind of intimate relationship and understanding the cycle of each other was very important for me. And I think that perhaps could be one of the solutions, is how we really forming this kind of close relationship to the material we're sourcing, rather than seeing it as a distance importation from somewhere that, you know, we don't really have to pay too much attention to.
Right. Yes. That already leads us to the next question, my next question, which has to do with this concept of hybridity, which the podcast focuses on. And we've been looking at hybridity through the lens of art, architecture, ecology, mathematics, dance, and the culinary arts. So quite eclectic. And hybrids here are understood as a relationship between two or more individual bodies, or I think you mentioned at the beginning, entities, as you're looking at Ferro Atlas. that mingle, mix, or form a symbiosis, or even contaminate each other. So what would you say is the importance of hybridity, contagion, or contamination in your work, or more generally, the work Feral Atlas is doing?
So in many ways, Feral Atlas has become this, even though I've worked on the project, but it also formed this precedent for what I always look up to my later work. What fascinates me about Feral Atlas as a project is that the many forms of hybrid that existing within the project, not just the kind of project itself, but also the formation of the project. There's hybrids of genre, methodology, forms of noticing, representing, disciplinary approaches, and the hybrids of so much happening inside also bring friction as well. And I think that's the very interesting aspect of it, because through this combining together, learning from each other's languages, not quite understanding certain approaches and learning to understand, come up with all these very exciting sparks of the results, the end results we have that now is this piece of work called Feral Atlas. And there's so many outcomes we have never really been anticipated and didn't know how to even imagine from the beginning. So from my perspective, the Anthropocene detonated landscapes were a piece of drawing that I guess none of us really had ever expected what they would look like from the beginning. And in many ways for designers, this is very scary for not knowing what you're working on and then jumping onto the team, and is all about expectations, but no kind of tangible imagination of what even the format and even the size of the drawing, you know, all these kind of details. But I think that was really exciting because that comes from this hybrid format of collaboration. Is there's no prescribed expectation, you know, if I were to kind of jump on the project using my kind of architectural training background, that I really want every drawing to fit in the same frame, have in the same size. I want them to have similar scale. Perhaps it needs to be drawn in one program or another. But this has completely gone out of the disciplinary boundary, because now is not really about forms of representation solely anymore. It's about telling stories of this very complex narratives that has scientific research embedded in it, but it needs to kind of grab people's attention using the beauty of forms of representation to kind of express the knowledge. And that has translated through other aspects of the project as well, such as the field reports we have, the 79 pieces of the reports embedded in the Feral Atlas. Has this what we called, this is a term I'm borrowing from one of our editors, Jennifer Deager, called the Apache epistemics. That is juxtaposition of various different perspectives and lenses together, sometimes even on the similar topic or the same topic, but is really trying to help the viewers to understand one common issue or problem or phenomenon itself from different perspective. For example, for the salmon farming, we have indigenous activists and a social scientist writing from completely different approaches. One is really personal story about how salmon used to be abundant for the First Nation communities. Due to salmon farming, it has been hugely kind of damaged because this kind of industrialized way of salmon pen. And for the social scientist who's writing through a more kind of scientific research approaches, data analyzing and then telling us exactly what's going on within the salmon pen. So the two stories, two reports combining together giving us an overview of how the salmon farming itself, through the industrialization itself, as well as impact on indigenous communities, is this kind of giving you a variety of approaches and understanding topics in the Anthropocene, because it truly is Anthropocene effects is patchy, and these patchy effects happening at spots, at this what we call the hot spots, and it has these uneven effects on different human communities. And we need to listen to different voices, and we need to understand different approaches. And to me, knowledge has no hierarchy. So the hybrid format is also being willing to listen, to be open-minded to multiple perspectives.
Where is the salmon farming geographically located, the case study you were looking at?
In Fair Atlas, that's in Canada.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. So the First Nation territory had an abundance of natural salmon. So, you know, the communities will go foraging, hunting, whereas the industrial salmon pen has imported loads of salmon from such as Norway and all the other places. And during that kind of mixing of different salmon species, that firstly has this conflicts between ecosystem kind of exchange. At the same time, the crowding kind of condition of salmon pen is making the salmon inside the salmon pen very vulnerable to disease. Because if one fish is infected by salmon lice, it goes around because there's nowhere to escape. Heather Swanson, who is one of the contributors, writing about the color, the natural kind of pink color of the salmon does not show through industrialized farmed salmon.
No, it's
salmon.
Much more wild salmon. It doesn't have so much fat, and it's much more like orange looking than pink. It doesn't have that salmon just come from.
Yeah. So the salmon color is also a kind of artificial color that's being injected to the industrial salmon. So all these kind of very interesting kind of knowledge that we are not exposed to is through the two elevated pieces of our article to give us, you know, a different understanding and different, I guess, distances in observation as well. So we give you an overview from a distance observation and a very more personal empirical kind of experiences of how that has impacted a specific community.
And how do your drawings or drawing as a medium inform the Feral Atlas? Would you say, is there any difference with other mediums, or is it just, you know, a tool for expressing?
I think it's many things at the same time. Firstly, the drawing has the responsibility or has a role of forming a analytical framework on infrastructures. So the drawing is a compilation of different infrastructure projects that form the analysis of how it's difficult to say without giving an introduction on the Anthropocene detonated landscapes. So in Fair Atlas, we have four of these landscapes, each titled Invasion, Empire, Capital, and Acceleration. So there has been kind of various, I guess, debates or discussions on exactly where Anthropocene or when Anthropocene has started. In Fair Atlas, rather than focusing on one specific time, we want to present how a series of historical conjunctures, such as European invasion to the other landscapes, imperial force for landscape modifications, capitalism and the great acceleration in terms of, you know, fast production of goods. These four parallel axes of analyzing the Anthropocene have all coexisting in the Fair Atlas. So each drawing have a series of infrastructure programs to show how, say, invasion has really started changing the way humans understand infrastructures and build the way we build infrastructures. So from the point on of the European invasion, such as of Americas, we have changed the way we build infrastructures to facilitate that kind of, I guess, way of thinking. I mean, the easiest case to talk about perhaps is capitalism. So this case called, this drawing called Capital, which really were exploring this kind of ways of thinking, which is turning nature into assets, right? So how can we, if we see trees, we don't see trees anymore, we see timber. If we see a fruit plantation, we don't see kind of the fruit anymore, we see how we can multiply and turn it into a scale plantation. So these kind of, I guess, rationale behind financializing nature is realized through the grid. So now looking at our landscape is all gridded up because it's the most efficient way of planting. This is easiest to kind of embed it in water channels and feeding, you know, nutrients and all so on and so forth. So the way the drawing is curated is also kind of feed into the way how these specific individuals who created this world of the Anthropocene had imagined the world to be. So the kind of drawing style also correlate to the perspective of how the world is created. And similarly to kind of acceleration, that we're really trying to explore the kind of fast production of goods, especially post the World War II, has, you know, everything is industrialized right now, factory made, really easy to access. But at the same time, the byproducts such as waste and toxins has also increased to the certain amount that perhaps exceed Earth's affordance. That's why, you know, I mentioned before, garbage ends into the ocean, also the landfill, toxins in the air, in the earth, in the water we're drinking. So we're really trying to kind of introduce this non-human species as well, because the point is we kind of have this out of sight, out of mind mentality, whereas really is the non-humans who are being exposed to these human waste product. So for people who is familiar perhaps of the Fair Alice drawings, acceleration has the majority of you know, the size of the drawing is actually this underwater perspective of imagining a marine species such as sea turtle looking at this cluster of waste in the ocean, and you're kind of looking through that through the surface of water, feeling so claustrophobic because this is your home, but being invaded by all these kind of human dumps. And that was a point of trying, even through the most naive effort, to depict this non-human perspective that we perhaps have been neglected for a very long time. So each drawing does represent very different lenses of approaching, lenses of viewing, and also kind of different time and different kind of starting historical events that has affected the way we understand and build infrastructure.
We got to, is there anything else you would like to add or tell us about that you've been working on, latest project, latest drawing?
I'm working on an architecture project. I'm reluctant to talk about it because it's in such early stage, but it has a beautiful story that my father, who was born in this tiny village in China, very poor, had made it out of the village. Now he is an engineer, he's worked abroad for many years, and a few years ago he went back to the village to visit and realize how close to zero changes has done to the village, which is kind of insane when you think about the scale of China. And he was very heartbroken. He saw his old neighbors, who I think recognize him still because he left as a young boy, but he was very ill. I think he got cancer, had no money to go through any sort of treatment, and he was just in his bed. So I think it really struck my father, and now he's using his savings for retirement to trying to kind of make some changes to this village. So I'm helping him as a project architect. So looking at regenerating this village through polyculture. So, I mean, we've also gone through the industrialized agriculture phase, that everything was extremely kind of machine reliant, but also this heavy use of pesticides on the earth, on the soil, on the plants, that became a huge problem in terms of health of diet in China. So we are looking at how we could go back to the original ways of understanding farming, as him growing up as a farm boy, and combining with various ways is not to reject machine completely, but also using the benefits and advantages of the machine to kind of revitalize this polyculture and multi-species whole kind of habiting way of agriculture and planting, and through that to try to generate revenue for the villagers who are being hugely neglected, unfortunately, by the society. So this is another project that we're working on. Is in a very early phase. He's talking to different biologists and experts in agriculture to try to understand exactly how the logistics of a farming would work. It's great. He, you know, used to help his family with my family to kind of plant these different vegetables like chives and beans. So he also understands, he has his own empirical knowledge towards that front. And for me is to understand how socially we can use design and architecture, combining with this organic ways of understanding farming, turn it into a community activity, and how through that we can help regenerate this village that he grew up in. So I just think is a heartwarming story to mention.
No, it's a beautiful, it sounds like a beautiful project. And I think it's the perfect image to close with this conversation. And yeah, I wish you good luck with that. And we look forward to hearing more about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation.